season 2 of the Design in Transition podcast, a bilingual audio tapestry where we weave interviews, commentaries, and artistic explorations in Spanish and English. We converse about designing for systems level change towards more sustainable and equitable futures, as well as the transitions design is taking in theory and practice. Today's conversation is in English. We will now direct our Spanish-speaking listeners to the end of the episode for the commentary in Spanish. La conversación de hoy es en inglés. Te invitamos a escuchar nuestra discusión en español acerca de esta al final del episodio.
Hi, this is Erica, and I'm excited for you to listen to this episode. In it, you'll hear from DU professor Thomas Nail, author of many books including Theory of the Migrant and Being in Motion. And you'll hear from Christiana Bugalo, founder of State Free, a platform that connects and provides information for stateless people around the world. I met Christiana in a democracy fellowship we've participated in through Humanity in Action and the Alfred Landecker Foundation. First, we'll hear from Christiana, who'll speak to her experience as a stateless person in a system of passport apartheid that perpetuates senseless inequities. Christiana has reframed the entire conversation. She's not specifically advocating that all stateless people become stated citizens, only if they so wish. For her, it's about being state-free, as a human on the earth, able to move and participate freely. Next, we'll link the conversation with Professor Thomas Nail, whose writing on the primacy of motion and the figure of the migrant speak to theoretical underpinnings of how societies might move towards an orientation in which humans are primarily migratory as opposed to sedentary. In linking these conversations, we're asking, how do we design for a world with the free movement of people?
Welcome, Christiana, to Design in Transition, Diseño en Transición. We're really, really excited to have you here. For some context, I'm Erica Dorn, and I'm one of the hosts of Design in Transition. Today, also Nandini Nair is with us, who's a new host to the podcast.
Hi, everyone. I am a master's student at the School of Design in Carnegie Mellon. I'm also a product designer at Kumu.io and Weaver, and I'm looking forward to this chat.
Yeah, I'm really as well. And to give a little more context, I'm moving into my third year of the Transition Design PhD program, but I've had the great fortune of being a fellow with Humanity in Action and the Alfred Landecker Foundation with 30 other fellows from around the world who are reinventing democratic spaces. And Christiana Bucalo, who's here with us today, is one of the fellows. I've been incredibly inspired by her work and am really excited for all of you to learn more about what she's up to. Welcome, Christiana. I'm going to hand it over to Nandini, who will kick us off.
Yeah, welcome, Christiana. We're very happy to have you here. We would love to hear a little bit more about your work. So if you could introduce your work to our listeners, that would be great.
Yes, thank you. Also for the very kind words. I'm very happy to be here. My name is Christiana. I am based in Munich. And actually, in my day job, I work in the area of diversity and inclusion. And since a few months, so maybe already over a year, actually, I have started a project which is now actually turning into a nonprofit organization, which is called State Free. Our platform is called statefree.world. That's the domain. And our aim is to build a digital space in which people who are affected by the topic of statelessness can come together, share their stories with each other, and share their experiences with each other, but also actually connect to people who we call their allies, meaning people who are working on the topic of statelessness.
That's amazing. Can you tell us a little bit more about what brought you to this kind of work?
Yes, I can. So it's a story that starts actually with my birth. So I was born in Munich. And since I was born, as my parents couldn't really provide sufficient documents to prove their identity, at least in terms of the German law, we were affected by statelessness since I was born. So this is actually a topic that has been part of my life ever since. But I have to admit that, especially in the beginning of the year, so when I was younger, I never focused too much on the topic of statelessness. I think that's also because my parents were mainly the people who were the ones administrating our lives. So I did notice that there are some differences in how I am able to live my life in comparison to maybe my friends did or other people did. But then again, my parents laid a lot of emphasis on education. So what I was focused on was making sure that I go to school and that would make my parents happy and myself as well. But then at a certain point in time, that was actually when I turned 18. That was the first time we got a passport. So I always say passport and it's always wrong because actually as a stateless person, you're not entitled to have a passport. You have a travel document. But for me, I recognized that it looked like or similar to passports, which my friend had. So that's when I learned the term stateless. And I feel like from that day on, I didn't even have a choice of not interacting with the topic in that sense or with the issue. So I became more aware of it also because at some point I moved out of my parents' home. So I was forced to administrate my own life. I started a job and so forth. And that's when the complications became more obvious to me. At some point, I then decided to build a platform which allows those people to actually talk to each other about what they're experiencing.
Wow, that, thank you so much for sharing that personal story. Can you give us a little bit more detail into, you know, how does one become stateless? So you've shared your story, but are there other ways that statelessness occurs? And what are some of these conditions that lead to people becoming stateless?
Yeah, that's a tough question, actually, because there are a lot of ways people could become stateless. And there is, so if you look at the history, it started with the rise of nation states, if we want to put it that way. And at some point around 19th century, nation states became a thing, I would say. And the way for nation states to communicate who belongs to them was by providing or handing out citizenship. And the thing is that at this point, countries or nation states also started weaponizing this construct of citizenship. So in history, there were other reasons. So for example, people just decided, or nation states simply decided that a certain group of people would be naturalized while another group of people wouldn't be. Currently, there are more, let's call them modern reasons, which are also very strong intertwined with migration. It's very, very complicated for a person that doesn't have the right documents to actually prove their identity. So what happens is that their identity is not recognized and their papers are not recognized. So from that point on, they have a lot of barriers to at some point even be able to apply for certain, for example, the residence permit, or even seeking asylum is very hard. So this is very basic. Then again, there are other cases. For example, there are countries in which there are simply gender discriminating laws in which women actually not pass on their nationality to their children. So if you don't know the nationality of a father, or if you maybe are not in contact with the father anymore because of certain, maybe also personal reasons, you don't have the opportunity to pass on your nationality to the child. So the child is born stateless.
I'm just taking in what you said about the construct of citizenship. And so statelessness is almost like you don't check any of the boxes. And so you're outside that construct of citizenship. And many different people around the world kind of have this problem because of how the documents or the process basically don't include them. So I can see how that kind of ties in quite nicely with maybe the diversity and inclusion work that you're also doing. And yeah, so I'm curious to know, you know, you're in this fight to end statelessness, what does fighting to this end actually look like? What are some of the pathways to statehood? Or are there any new or different forms of belonging that could be explored in this space?
Yeah, very good question. By default, people tend to think that I'm fighting to end statelessness. I haven't really decided whether that's what I'm actually doing, because it sounds awkward to say I don't care about statelessness, but it's more that being without state or being without citizenship was never a problem to me because I wanted a citizenship. It was a problem for me because of the circumstances I have to experience due to not having a citizenship. So if I would be able to be stateless and still have the same rights as any other person, I think that it would be okay for me. But that's a very subjective perspective, obviously, because there are people who identify a lot with certain countries, and you can have a national identity, right? So you can identify with a nation while not having a citizenship. And for me, I have to admit that I don't want to say I never felt like I don't belong, but especially as a child, I have family, we were or are pretty close. So it took a while until I understood that there's a certain environment which is telling me that I don't belong. So this is the point in which what is happening in the outside world starts affecting what you're feeling in your inner world. So what I wanted to make sure is that people have the information they need. And at some point I understood that there is information, but it's extremely fragmented in different organizations with different people who are active in that area. And I simply like things to be together and like a certain overview of things. And so this is when I decided, okay, what is missing is actually, it's simply communication right now that is missing. Oftentimes they're you don't even have clear statelessness determination processes. That's why the question about how you become stateless is extremely tricky, because sometimes it simply depends on the person you are talking to at the asylum office, right? So, or immigration office. So there are a lot of issues simply baked into this whole system. And for me, the fight right now starts with bringing together people, making sure that they feel like they belong, because there is a huge group of people that is experiencing the same thing.
By the way you're describing it, there is something attractive to a stated person, which is to be state free, which it's really beautiful the way you've reframed statelessness to your organization now called State Free, because in that sense, it sounds what your mission is to build almost like a supra nationhood, which is nation or sort of belonging beyond the nation state paradigm. And so you're building this network of people across the globe who are state free, and you're helping them network information that would allow them to live their lives with more ease and presumably to travel about the planet in the way that humans ought to, which is freely. Does it feel like you're in this beginning stage of building a supra, I guess, deterritorialized network that allows people like yourself to really in some ways build a new paradigm of existence, of belonging?
It changes from time to time depending on my mood. Obviously, I did have situations in which I thought, okay, maybe we simply need another like structure system that is simply only made for state-free people and that helps them with what they need. But then again, there are times in which this is simply born out of the need of wanting to have the same rights, right? So I'm not sure whether it's the right solution to build another construct. And that's actually something I would want to avoid. For me, it's more about changing the mindset and questioning why this is even happening. I feel like we are so much used to this construct that nobody ever thinks about the fact that this is all made up and off. Maybe there were some benefits and reasons to it. And I even have empathy with the governments in that sense. And now I feel like I understand because they have their reasons, right? But this then again, so them denying my citizenship should also mean that they're not able to decide whether I'm able to travel somewhere. And this is something I'm struggling with. So for me, it's not so much about building or coming up with something new that is then simply focused on people who are without citizenship, but it's more about just really thinking about and making people also within the system think about why that system is the way it is and whether it's time at some point to maybe adapt step by step and make it work.
I love what you're evoking when you talk about not wanting to build another system or another construct. So does it sound more, would it be a better metaphor of sorts to say then that you're wanting to kind of remove barriers or sort of erase bureaucracy that seems to be quite cumbersome for everyone and quite useless? Or do you see, you know, in your, because I see how you're approaching this in a really empathetic and also really rational ways. Do you see any benefit to the nation state in keeping the construct, or you really do see the need to kind of remove these artificial barriers and, you know, the idea of abolishing citizenship? Does that sound like an enticing proposition to you?
So I wouldn't abolish it, because I think that it's important to people and I completely respect that. I think there are people who are maybe Brazilian and they're proud of being Brazilian. They're also proud of having the Brazilian nationality, and that's totally fine. I just feel like a person should be free to decide what exactly they identify with. And then whatever they decide it shouldn't have anything to do with whether or not they have access to basic human rights.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I'm hearing is a lot about, you know, the pluriverse, the plurality of ways in which humans can exist with the planet, within the planet. I'd be curious, yeah, if you could describe a little bit more about the mission of State Free, and how do you feel about people in that position of having, say, more passports than they need to sort of say, I want to join State Free. This seems more enticing to me than being stated.
I feel positive. I don't mind in that sense. I think it's great. I think that's what, because I would never create any barriers to stage free, because I know how it feels to be confronted with barriers like those, right? So for me, I've had those conversations already since I started. There were a few people saying that they actually would want to be state free because they feel like this is something that allows them to view the world as one and allows them to get rid of those different categories they have in their minds. And in terms of the mission of state free, well, I have a lot of ideas right now. I would say our midterm mission is to have a safe space in which stateless people or state-free people feel like they belong. So the mission is definitely to have a space in which people are also free to speak up and in which they feel comfortable, in which they have the feeling that they're supported by persons, and also the feeling that statelessness is not invisible, because it becomes extremely visible in those places.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting to hear. Something that I'm doing in my master's is researching mutual aid and how mutuality is created within groups. And what I'm hearing from you is, you know, you're creating almost like a mutual aid network of stateless people, building solidarity, building capacity so that you can, when the time is right or when opportunities present itself, you've got this you know, group of people, this body of people who are aligned, have a shared vision, have a common language to then take action. Does that sound about right?
Yes, it sounds very much right. Very well summarized. And so the thought of people simply being aligned on this topic is like already it's a huge mission already, right? So, and I just directly thought about how it would feel for me to know that there are people actually exactly understanding what is happening, not only what I've experienced, but also where we are going and where we are trying to go. And this already this makes up a part of belonging, right? Feeling like there are people around you that know why you are here and also why they're here and why we make a group together.
In the last Academy for Afrobandiker that we were at together, you said something really interesting about the fact that there are organizations, there's like the Institute to End Statelessness or the, you know, Center for Statelessness Studies. And forgive me, I don't think that's the name of those organizations, but you were describing these organizations that do exist. And you said something that as a stateless person, when you go to those websites or those organizations, it became very clear to you that they were speaking to maybe other academics or other politicians or other people working in kind of international governance, but they weren't speaking to anyone who was actually experiencing statelessness, that wasn't a place that you as a stateless person could go to find information about how to navigate the world. And so there's this major disconnect between organizations trying to shift and perhaps advocate for people like yourself. And, you know, it seems that they're not quite aware of that. And when you mentioned that you're not an activist, I started to think, well, I wonder if you consider yourself a designer, or sometimes I call myself a social choreographer, because I know you are also a dancer. And I think it's good to resist terms that maybe don't fulfill or fill our kind of essence or that don't feel right. And so on that vein, I thought it might be interesting to just hear you describe a little bit about your vision for systems change. And so who are some of the players out there, they're people creating interventions that you see yourself coalescing around?
So there are two organizations. One is the European Network on Statelessness, and the second one is the Institute on Statelessness and Inclusion. And you're completely right. You're absolutely right. And when I found the website of the ENS, I was happy but confused because I had never heard about it before. I reached out to them. And what happened is that I'm not sure whether it was simply the right time or maybe it was also my approach and the project. And since then, a lot has changed. So what I'm noticing, and that's why I also wonder whether it was simply the right time or a point in time in which they had also realized that they need to be more in touch with people who are stateless. Because what has happened since then is actually, those are things I never even dreamed about. So currently I'm working very closely with them. They have been incredibly helpful. So there's one thing explicitly that happened this year, which was that I was asked whether I would want to join the board of trustees of the ENS. So for me, that was like, okay, they are actually walking the talk. And because I think there are a lot of organizations saying that we need to put those who are affected at the center and the core of our discussions and at the core of what we're doing. And they have been communicating a lot of times that they want to focus more on working with communities and want to amplify their voices and so forth. But amplifying voices can also mean to simply ask for an interview. And it can also mean to maybe ask for a video or pictures to publish on your online channels to speak to the issue you're solving, right? But then that doesn't really change anything. So I was extremely happy and I'm still also very grateful about that. So I joined their board of trustees in March. And I still can't believe it, actually. Since then, a lot of things have just simply changed. And I'm so surprised about it also, because I feel like it changed in a very short time period. So this is one thing that I feel like that is progressing a lot already. In terms of one thing that I'm missing, it's not so much an organization, but actually a layer, and that is digitalization and technologies. I feel like oftentimes the areas of social justice are lacking behind in that area. And I would wish also, because there's a lot of potential and it's important that also in those areas, people who are designing in that sense, who are designing our future world in terms of technology, should be representative already now of the people that are in our society, right? So if we wait again until there are new systems and new kinds of bureaucracy that don't include the issue of statelessness, we would be at the same point as we are right now. So that's maybe one of the things I would like to see in future.
Given all the things there are to be learned, what do you think humans living on Earth today need to learn?
There are so many things. a lot of things, actually. Maybe it's not so much about learning, but, and this is something that I think has been discussed a lot, especially in the last couple of months, but really forgetting and unlearning all the things that we have simply just embedded into our reality. I'm currently thinking a lot about how I felt as a child and how different that person is in comparison to the person now. And I feel like I need to forget all of the things that we were told, all of those categories and all of those, I don't want to say rules, because there are a few rules and those are important, but even the rules that are important, we tend to forget them. There's also the rule in that sense to simply treat other people the way you want to be treated. But still, we as human beings, we just really oftentimes fail to act that way. So yes, that is important. But I think one thing, if I would have to choose, is simply to find our way back to who we actually are as human beings. Because I think if we find that way back to our core, we are also able to treat people in our surrounding with the right respect and right love. And yeah, so I think that would be the one thing.
Well, you know, anything else you'd like to leave our listeners with in terms of how they could get involved with your work, or even just anything else they might want to ponder as, you know, I remember you saying something in our last conversation about how when you used to describe what it is to be stateless, that people would always ask you, well, where are your parents from? What is their nation state? And you would often just decide to not tell people because you wanted people to feel the uncomfortability or the uncomfort of that lack of categorization of not knowing. And I just remember thinking that's powerful. So you know, on that vein, are there anything else you want to leave our listeners with in terms of food for thought?
Yeah. So in terms of how to get involved, in case there are listeners that work in the area of law or politics or anything that is somehow connected to the topic, I would say it would be a great thing to actually educate yourself on the topic and question whether there are certain parts of your work in which you actually cross the path, if you want to say, of migration, because oftentimes statelessness is not specifically addressed, but it's a different topic. So simply educate yourself and think about whether or not there's something you might be overlooking that applies to stateless people. If you are maybe stateless, or if you know somebody who's stateless, visit our website and sign up to the list. In terms of last thoughts, I think it is important that we try to retrain our brain. And that's what I meant by simply staying in that discomfort of not knowing where my parents are from. Because for me, I really don't feel like my belonging is tied to a nation state. And that is not because my parents didn't teach me their culture. And that is not because I tried to avoid the culture I am seeing in Germany. It's not. But that's simply because at some point, apparently, or maybe it's also because of the status, I never felt like I need to be part of the country or need to identify with the country. And I think we also, when looking at other people, simply need to question, what difference does it make to us? Because if it does make a difference, that means that you obviously have certain assumptions about what that country might say about the person. Because if you wouldn't, you probably wouldn't care so much. So I feel like retraining our need for a category would be very helpful for us as human beings.
You've just heard from Christiana Bugolo of State Free. We will now connect to an interview with professor and philosopher Thomas Nail, known for his work on theories of motion. These two interviews are intended to illuminate theory and practice towards the free movement of people globally.
All right, so Thomas, welcome to Design in Transition, Diseño en Transición. Thomas is a professor of philosophy at the University of Denver and is the author of numerous books, including The Figure of the Migrant, Theory of the Border, Marx in Motion, Returning to Revolution, and Being and Motion. Your research focuses on the philosophy of movement, and you also work with the migrant justice group, No One is Illegal. Welcome to the podcast. Well, I wanted to just kind of start out with a little bit more about what brings you to do this kind of work and kind of your own positionality within some of the work you're authoring.
Yeah, so I think without going too far into the long backstory, the most immediate backstory is that in 2010, I did a Fulbright scholarship in Canada to work with the migrant justice group, No One is Illegal, in Toronto. And that was a very eye-opening experience. It was nice to have a year where I could just basically read political theory and do activism and just live that life. And it was wonderful. And I learned a lot from the activists and from the political theory. Political philosophers really never took seriously migration and borders. It's not that nobody ever talked about them. It's just that it was a very, very small, minor, and inconsequential topic for political theorists, which now, today, that's absolutely just shocking. You couldn't believe that that's true, but there really wasn't that much literature. And so that really, I don't know, it made me quite cranky and inspired to try to write something and try to work that out. The basic idea is that what if that was not the best way of thinking about societies? What if either a more inclusive understanding of citizenship or one that started instead with migration and mobility? What if mobility was first and that was the primary constituting thing that made up societies? And then eventually citizens just get delineated as one portion of that really large group of mobile people moving around throughout history. And so I tried to track all that history. I won't try to summarize it all, but I'll just say that I've written a bunch of books on different topics of, you know, art and science and ecology and all these other things as they pertain to this issue of movement, which I find to be something that theorists don't usually think about nearly enough. And if they do, it's always as some kind of secondary thing. Like first we have states, then people move between the states. And so my work is sort of asking the question, what if we inverted that? And we said, what if movement occurs first and it kind of produces these metastable states? And we thought about states and countries and nations as metastable, meaning that they are continually taking in energy and releasing energy. And they're that kind of like a whirlpool or an eddy. They're just kind of only stable because of all the movement, not in spite of the movement, but because of the movement, they can have some kind of relative stability.
It's really interesting to hear you talk about the pattern of how your thoughts led you to really movement as being something that needs reprioritized or sort of brought into balance with the idea of sedentarianism or fixity. And I guess one question is, are you sensing, I think I may have read this in one of your books, that the universe is in fact expanding. Not only are we more in motion than ever before, and at many scales we can see that happening on Earth, not just from humans moving, but also our entire universe expanding. Do you see a philosophy of motion taking hold more and more as you've gotten deeper into this work? Do you see it materializing around you, or are we still stuck very much so deeply in a world of fixity?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I think, yeah, the philosophy of movement, it's aspirational. I hope that people take movement more seriously in the future, not just philosophers, but really everybody. There is a weird kind of, like you said, I think for the most part, culturally, we're in this moment of transition, a kind of denial. We know climate change is happening. We know how many tens or hundreds of people, hundreds of thousands of people are dying every year because of like air pollution, how much wildlife is being destroyed. Like we know the destruction that's being caused, but we're kind of right at the limit of like, well, we're not all dying yet, right? And so we still have time to either fix the problem, reverse this perception that we are walking on the earth and it's supposed to be this stable thing that we can move around on and do things with. But it's not really stable. It's a very unstable process. It's very metastable and you can't mess with it or you'll throw off the whole balance. And socially, we're at the limits there too. Climate change and migration, these are huge, absolutely big world historical moments of transition. It's not that the nation state was ever a good idea, but we've committed to it. We being the nation states of the world, I suppose, those colonizing Western European nation states have committed to this idea that they're going to chop everything up into nation states. And that's never really worked, but we are at a critical threshold where the quantity of migration, of global migrants and refugees is increasing very dramatically. I mean, we're not exactly at World War II levels yet, but we have a lot of migration. This is definitely like a third age of great migration. But the problem is like the nation state's not really set up to handle that. To handle really large movements of people. And so you have all these incredible inequalities. You have an entire third almost of the United States that can't even vote. Like, how is that democratic? I mean, how can you say that we believe in democracy when a third of the country can't vote because of various different degrees of status? The numbers are quite dramatic of how many climate change related refugees we're going to start seeing. It's not exactly a natural disaster. It's partly a historical post-colonial capitalist disaster that some people are forced into a position of migrating, and then they migrate, but there's not really a formal status yet of climate refugee. And that's a big problem, and it's going to be a big problem.
Right. And I think that kind of relates to our next point, where we wanted you to explain the movement-oriented or kinetic theory of Earth that you talk about on your latest book, Theory of Earth. Can you just, for our listeners, kind of like summarize what this is about?
Yeah, so this book, Theory of the Earth, that just came out, that is one of the books, the last book that I wrote in the series. So there's like a 6-volume series that's in the philosophy of movement. And this is the 6th one. And each of the books deal with a different aspect, politics, you know, art, ontology, science. And this one focuses on nature. And in particular, I mean, it starts with the history of the cosmos. So it's kind of a retelling of the history of the Earth from the perspective of movement and metastability. So the thing is, we've adopted just kind of by habit, humans, that is, after the last glacial age, there's a period that we're now living in, maybe on the transition point, called the Holocene. And the Holocene is called that because it's a kind of relatively stable period where the temperatures are beneficial to us and we can survive in them. And there's not that much dramatic change relative when you look at the other previous parts of Earth history. It's all over the place. Global ice ages, volcanic eruptions, like it's really hot, really cold, you know, craters, impacts, meteors, all kinds of stuff. But we are in this little period. And the thing is like we've kind of grown up in it as humans. And so we're like, oh yeah, the Earth, it's just this nicely temperatured, perfectly, you know, not super disrupted by anything terrible. It's like, well, yeah, but we're living in a tiny fraction of Earth's history. But we have this idea that the Earth was supposed to be kind of there for us, stable, relatively, you know, predictable. It's not going to do anything crazy or dramatic. But that's only because of millions and billions of years of evolution produced this particular metastable state. But we acted like it wasn't a metastable state. We pretended like it was just the state of the Earth. And it wasn't even really until like 19th century that, you know, geologists were like, well, maybe it wasn't so stable. And now we know for sure it was never stable. This was never a stable place. It's a fragile system and we can screw it up. And we basically have. We've destroyed half of the amount of trees on the planet. We just, I mean, this is like just a few years ago with the with satellite technology. We know that there are 3 trillion trees on the planet, but there actually used to be twice as many. 6 trillion trees. And since humans have arrived, have evolved, we've destroyed, I should really be careful with that because I certainly don't mean all humans there. I mean, some very specific groups of humans who have sought advantage by destroying the trees have destroyed half the trees on the planet. We've thought about it as like, it's always going to be there. We can just keep taking and taking and taking and it'll all be fine. And so I think that's not just it's not just a naive assumption. It's partly historical, it's partly material, and it's partly philosophical, which is that we have a very static, stasis-based view of the Earth. We think about life as something to be conserved, like we want to protect our own lives, that life is about protecting itself and conserving what it is, and that the Earth itself, to protect it, we need to conserve energy. And I think that that's not quite what's up. I think it's not totally a question of conservation, in part back to the trees. Trees, when you take a look at what they do at a material level, they are all about dissipation of energy, not conservation. The energy that they take in from the sun, from the air, from the ground, 99% of that energy is radiated back out of the trees through heat and water into the atmosphere and recycled. Nature is it works by dissipation, and that's a very... That's a complex systems idea to think that things are metastable states and that they keep going because they dissipate. And right now we're in a state of climate change and, you know, global extinction of tons of species, in part because it's like we have only thought about our own energy. Like, oh, humans are just consuming so much energy. It's not about humans alone. It's how they're consuming their energy as it relates to the rest of the planet. And what's the planet doing? The planet is not conserving. The point is to absorb energy from the sun, break it down, and radiate it into space. Anyway, the point about humans is that it's what we've done. We have to look at the whole Earth system as a whole system of systems and not just think like, oh, humans are consuming too much energy. No, the point is that the planet as a whole is not consuming or dissipating enough energy. Why? Because we've destroyed our biggest energy consuming, dissipating organisms, trees.
Right. So that makes me think two things. Oftentimes, design is thought as the making of the artificial. So I would like you to give us your own conception of what design is. And maybe if you could speculate, how can design become a dissipator?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it really depends on, I suppose, what's being designed. I mean, I think in short, I would like to define design much more broadly, like not strictly in an anthropocentric way, like only humans get to be the artificers of nature or something like that. I think nature is, yeah, totally creative, like not just in any mechanical way, like it's forced to be. But again, back to that idea of the swerve, nature, if nature really is indeterminate in quantum physics, indeterminacy, if you just go down low enough, you're going to find states that are not particles, they're fields. And their energies change and move not determinately. They're not in a determinate state, which is a crazy idea that this just is not, it's not a thing. It's not an object. It's not even a particle. It's an indeterminate fluctuation of energy. How can we design a dissipating energy system? So for one, we can take a lot of good cues from nature. So that's why I would want to say nature is a designer too. And that nature in that very broad sense, designed us. Like, we're also designed. We're designed things that design things. Like, everything else is a designed thing that designs things. If you think about it in that sense, there's a really good, I think, a lesson to be learned about natural dynamic systems and how they dissipate. Things like eddies, things like, you know, fractal structures, dendrites, like the way that trees branch out, the same way that slime molds spread out and look for food. There's a really great study. So some Japanese designers were designing the railway plan to connect a bunch of cities together. Like, what's the most efficient way to design a rail system that connects the most populated cities together? And so they spent like 20 years working on this plan, and they're like, oh, we got it. And so then some scientists basically, they put down, they made a little map with like little bits of food on a petri dish. The size of the food was relative to the size of the city. So they made it look like a map of Tokyo, or of the Tokyo area. And then they put a slime mold into the petri dish, and the slime mold branches out like a tree. It looks like just branches in all directions searching for food. And when it finds food, it strengthens and grows along the path to the food. And all the other ones that didn't find any food start to kind of become weak and die off. And very quickly, like within just, you know, minutes or hours, like the slime mold made a path between all the sources of food back to the center. And then they compared this map of the slime mold, I kid you not, to the railway system, and found that it basically produced almost the identical pattern. Maybe we should like take a look at how trees grow or how slime molds move and take a lesson, because those are all also dissipative systems. They are searching for food. Why? You could say, oh, well, they're just trying to live. Yeah, but what living is 10%. Of what they are actually doing. Like 10% of that energy goes to living, 90% of that energy goes to dissipation. Which one is really more important? I mean, again, it's a perspective. Both are happening. Yes, it is reproducing, but why is it reproducing? You could say, well, in order to live, but why is it living? But if you looked at the statistics of energy, you'd be like, well, it's living in order to waste. It's living in order to dissipate. Systems are way closer to being dissipative than they are to being conservative.
In terms of this phenomena that you're describing, this idea, one way I could apply this thinking to the everyday of our situation, where walls are becoming more common between nations, where livable earth is decreasing while populations are increasing, and especially populations on the move are increasing. Can we kind of go to this realm of thinking about the world today and how what's happening, this kind of apartheid that we live within, where some of us, like myself, have the passport that entitles me to quite a lot of free movement. And while you described, though, that this idea somewhere, you said migrant is not a fixed position, but a social position that anyone can move in and out of. I guess, how do we distinguish between this idea of the kind of kinetic elite and forced migrants on the spectrum of moving in and out of the position of being a migrant? And how can some of your, I guess, theories on this develop into real world change?
Yeah, so I guess there's a couple questions. The first one, I just agree with what you said, which is that there's absolutely a spectrum, which is why if somebody says to me like, oh, we're all migrants, it's, you know, well, we're not equally migrants, like we're not the same. And so one has to distinguish between all the different degrees and variations and all of those, you know, those singular ways in which people are migrant. In any case, so the other question you asked about, like, well, what about policy changes in general? I think there's only so much one could say about in general, because we'd have to look at specific cases if we were going to come up with any real policy solutions for specific cases. But I would say in general, one way to think about planning or urban planning or even design is to think about it, first of all, as an adaptive system that's metastable. And any point where you're committing too much for permanence, you're making a risk that what you, the structure of permanence that you're establishing is, you think that it's going to last and you're anticipating X, Y, and Z changes. If you think about design and architecture and planning instead of permanent structures, to think about them as adaptive systems where you're never absolutely committed to anything about that structure. And that's like hard to think about, like how could we have a modular system that could respond to what we can't anticipate yet?
Yeah, so I was thinking about what you were talking about, this aspect of a lot of the social systems being inflexible, whereas with the other examples that you were posing to us, telling the natural systems that have this, they're flexible, they go with the flow, going back to your theory of movement. So it makes me wonder, how do we reconcile this two? What is the process? What is that transition process of making our social systems more elastic? Or what are the different forces that they're against each other or helping each other? Is there a difference between motion and movement and the way you conceive it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I don't distinguish between movement and motion, but there are kind of three concepts that are just the core of the philosophy that do distinguish those things you're saying. It's in some places you would want to distinguish between like a flow and in another place, like a what I call a fold, which is just any process that's kind of iterative, like a cycle, like a whirlpool. You could say there's a flow of water that goes into an eddy and then circulates around that eddy. And then in some cases, you can have really big metastable composites where you've got a bunch of eddies working together. So if you look into like a creek or a river, you can see in that river, there's not just one eddy. And sometimes you can't even see the eddies. It's really cool. But if you get a direct sun overhead, you can see just the shadows of the vortices and they're all interlocked. The vortices emerge in these incredible interlocking patterns and then they dissipate and they only last a little while. But the difference we could say conceptually between flows that are just, you know, some stream of movement that hasn't become highly stable, relatively stable, whatever scale we're looking at. And then folds, which are places where that fold, that flow has kind of taken on a kind of stability to it. And we say, oh, look, there's, I don't know, whatever, there's a book. That's a metastable state. You know, the book won't always be there. It wasn't there always. And it is slowly but surely breaking down on my bookshelf and will eventually be destroyed one day. And then you can see the composite of all those different things of the world kind of added up. And that's what I would call like circulation.
Would you say that dissipation is your story?
Yeah. I mean, not just my story, but I'd say that it's nature's story. And I'm going to go with it because I'm nature too. But I would just say, I think that, I mean, I think if you look around, that's what the entire universe is up to. Everything's moving from hot to cold. That's entropy. And that's not a bad thing. Like, we don't have to think negatively about that because it made us. Like, that entropy is creative. But it only creates through dissipation. That's the lesson. And I would say that some people have taken that lesson very seriously and seen themselves as not exceptional. It's a story that's told, that nature can tell its stories. And I think if we listen to the stories that nature is telling, listen to the trees, what story are they telling? They're telling a story of incredible generosity. Most organisms are giving back everything almost to other organisms. That's generosity. Humans have a very different story, even though they're actively dissipating energy too. Our story is like, oh, but we don't want to waste it. And we have to develop nature because it would go to waste. So all I would say is, yes, it's not just my story, but I would go with the story of dissipation and kind of material generosity and creativity, as opposed to the other story of form imposing itself upon passive matter.
Thank you so much, Thomas. I think we have like 7 million other questions that we didn't get to ask you, but I thought we could end with one that we sort of started with before we pressed record, which was, you were talking about another author that wrote a book called On Borders. I thought you could speak a little bit to what you're intrigued about in that book. I guess I'd love to see if you could leave us with your thoughts on what dissipation and generosity looks like materialized in a, or designed into a system of immigration or movement globally. And I think you had mentioned that On Borders maybe presents an interesting case for that.
Yeah. So, well, I'll mention the book first, which I really loved, which is Paulina Espejo. Her book is called On Borders, and it's an interesting theory. She's sympathetic to the idea of open borders, but also hesitant because she worries, and I think rightly, that if we were just taking the world system as it is now and just opening borders, the problems that can happen is that, like, all that does is, if you just keep global capitalism in place and open borders, it means that you're going to be, people will migrate away from their countries of origin, and those countries of origin will become less strong. Like, they won't have the benefit of all of those workers and all those skills, and people will leave. And that they don't want that. That hurts their economy and it benefits the US economy. Every scholar who studies it knows, and every economist who's honest would tell you that the economy always benefits from immigration, whatever, you know, whatever the other populations might say because of racial bias or whatever. In any case, so it's important to note that open borders, I don't like the idea of like a wall at all, no matter how big the door is, no walls. I think that's, it's just like, yeah, whatever. It's just like, we need an immigration policy that lets more people in. That's, I think that's not the solution, to retain those walls and just have a bigger door to let more people in. But what is the point of even having that wall? Anybody who wants to move should, but you have to qualify that with two things. One, on the sides of receiving the sending countries, is that if you retain the system of global inequality, you know, that's only hurting those countries and those people. You're essentially forced, they don't want to move in many cases. They don't want to move at all, but they have to, they're economically compelled to move. So even though that's not legally considered forced migration, economic migration is a kind of forced migration if those people don't want to leave their country, but they have to for economic reasons because their country can't, you know, can't give them jobs or can't give them whatever because of global inequality. So that history and legacy of colonialism has to be addressed, and global inequality has to be addressed, or else opening borders doesn't really solve the problem on that level. The other side is the receiving country that's receiving the migrants. You can't just say like, let's open the borders and let people in. When what that actually means is they've got partial or no status and they can't vote and they don't have the same rights as everybody else there. All you're doing then is just open borders could, if all you did was open a border and keep global capitalism and keep national forms of identity and discrimination in place, all you would do is create an increasingly large population of unequal, dispossessed and marginalized people. And that's not good either. So the whole wall metaphor, just get rid of the wall at all. That's not the question. The question is, how do you create a responsive system that's in relationship to the rest of those other systems? So I mean that at a global level too. It's easy to say, much harder to do, obviously, but for me, it's hard to imagine a really good open borders idea without the abolition of global capitalism. I'm sorry if that sounds really big, but like, I can't just pretend like there's some workaround of global capitalism. Like, we'll just get around it in some way. We have to try things. Absolutely. But I think a long-term vision still needs to be there, no matter how long-term, no matter how impossible it feels. I think it still needs to be a realistic part of any vision is the end of capitalism.
Yo soy Alex Pulzin. Y estoy acompañado por Sofía Bosch-Gómez. Acabemos de escuchar dos entrevistas que se tratan de migración, movimiento y el momento de transición en que estamos, lo cual está puntuado por el crisis climático, los estados nacionales y el capitalismo. En la primera entrevista, la cual escuchamos, Cristiana Búcalo, la fundadora de State Free, una red para personas que no se pertenecen a ningún estado, es decir, son ciudadanos de ningún país. Esta red se intenta hacer comunidad entre ellos y apoyarles con recursos y tal, mientras dar visibilidad y a esta condición política y moderna. La segunda entrevista fue con Thomas Nail, un profesor de filosofía que está enfocado en temas de inmigración y movimiento, y él propone la pregunta de ¿qué cambiaría si cómo organiza el mundo si el movimiento fue priorizado sobre la ciudadanía? Sofía, ¿qué anotabas tú en la entrevista con Cristiano?
Muchas gracias, Alex. Qué gusto estar aquí contigo. Creo que justo algo importantísimo en la entrevista de Cristiana es esta idea de el ser apátrida, ¿no? No tener una ciudadanía y por ende no tener acceso a los mismos derechos que un ciudadano de un cierto territorio. Una de las cosas importantes que ella mencionaba es justamente que el ser apátrida no quiere decir que no tengas derecho a ciertos cumplimientos de derechos humanos o de necesidades básicas. Entonces esto de verdad nos empuja un poco como Thomas, ¿no?, a cambiar nuestra perspectiva de cómo nos consideramos en nuestro mundo, en este mundo, en un mundo en movimiento y que viendo hacia futuro va a ser cada vez más, justamente va a estar mucho más en movimiento, dado que tendremos pues cambios relacionados al cambio climático que probablemente muevan y empujen a grandes poblaciones a moverse. Entonces, justo a mí una de las cuestiones que más se me hacía interesante, ¿no? Y que me provocaba como este cuestionamiento es cuáles son estos caminos para pensar en un esquema diferente al que conocemos hoy de los estados-nación, ¿no? Es tan intrínseco en nuestro ser, tiene tanto que ver con cómo nos definimos, que cómo es que podemos pensar justamente en ciudadanías en movimiento o estas ciudadanías fluctuantes o este hecho de no necesitar una ciudadanía para poderse mover alrededor del mundo. ¿A ti qué te pareció, Alex?
Completamente de acuerdo. Me impresionó como Thomas se describió el país como algo artificial y que se, en cambio se podría ser un, como él da el ejemplo de, no sé cómo se dice en español, de hecho, como en un río, los círculos que hacen el agua cuando fluye por los remolinos por el agua y como es, no es algo fundamental, sino algo que se puede cambiar y ser dinámico y a responder y dispensar la energía o las personas o los recursos que se entran, sino no es una, algo construido y final, sino cómo se podemos construir sistemas que se pueden adaptar y cambiar a la gente que se mueva.
Sí, definitivamente. Es uno de los grandes retos, ¿no? Hacia el futuro. Pensando justamente, bueno, si lo pensamos nada más en nuestras fronteras aquí con Estados Unidos, ahorita yo que estoy en México, justamente, ¿no? La cuestión del muro, la cuestión de quién pasa y quién no pasa, de quién sí tiene un pasaporte o un visado para entrar a ciertos lugares y quién no puede entrar a otros. Un poco como lo comentaba Thomas, está ligado y va de la mano como con estos sistemas coloniales, con estos sistemas de dominación entre naciones. Entonces, me pareció interesante que una de las cosas que menciona es que si de verdad queremos no empujar por otro tipo de sistemas, hay una necesidad palpante de trabajar justamente para desmantelar estos sistemas supuestamente poscoloniales, ¿no? Pero que siguen bastante arraigados en este colonialismo del siglo XIX.
Exacto, exacto. Neil explica que si estamos intentando cambiar solo un poquito, el poquito, al límite y no tomar el enfoque del sistema total, no vamos a realizar el cambio necesario para el futuro del planeta, de hecho, y la respuesta no, la solución no es como muros más grandes y puertas más grandes, sino tenemos que pensar en por qué tenemos los muros. Y lo que ha dicho Sofía, y empezamos, si podemos empezar desde esta perspectiva, se permite entrar en un proceso de diseño para construir o deconstruir un futuro posible.
Sí, totalmente. No, totalmente de acuerdo, Alex. Creo que hay una idea interesante, ¿no?, que emerge de estas dos conversaciones con Cristiana y con Tomás. Es esta idea de dar por sentado ciertos sistemas y dar por sentadas ciertas interacciones. Una cuestión importante, ¿no?, que de la cual nos platica Thomas, es esta idea que los humanos siempre queremos conservar, queremos mantener las cosas estáticas en vez de considerarlas y entenderlas en movimiento. Que si cambiáramos justamente nuestra perspectiva o este encuadre, la forma en la que abordamos el problema, ¿no?, y lo entendiéramos desde un principio de sistemas vivos, desde la idea de la disipación de energía en vez de la conservación de energía, que es una cosa que hace nuestro planeta constantemente, ¿no? Y hasta menciona que justamente lo que hacen los árboles en nuestro planeta es disipar energía, no es que la conserven. Entonces, si entendiéramos, por ejemplo, el movimiento de humanos en el mundo justamente desde esta perspectiva de disipación en vez de conservación, de estaticismo, tal vez justamente podríamos llegar a otro tipo de diseños o estructuras sociales que respondieran a... Y Alex, ¿nos podrías contar o comentar cuál fue una de tus citas favoritas de esta entrevista?
Ah, pregunta difícil, porque había muchas. Creo que había un momento en que Cristiana estaba hablando de los Estados-naciones y dijo la admonición que todo está imaginado, como this is all made up. Y eso me dio un choque. Es una invitación a cambiar.
Sí, definitivamente. El pensar que en realidad todos esos esquemas son artificiales.
De acuerdo. Y él da también el ejemplo de, dice que la naturaleza es un diseñador también y tenemos que observar y tomar ejemplos y tal desde lo que podemos ver en el mundo natural, que se puede incluir los seres humanos también.
Me encanta eso, Alex, pensar en el planeta como un diseñador y cómo como diseñadores podíamos aprender justamente de estos sistemas vivos.
Exacto, y eso es para si podemos tomar esta perspectiva y aplicarlo al diseño urbano y pensar en el diseño urbano como el diseño metaestable, como sistemas adaptivas que son modular, y si podemos aplicar esto al diseño, podemos anticipar o empezar a ver, utilizar la palabra civilización, pero una red de conexiones, interconexiones entre gente y que se puede cambiar.
Sí, y me encanta como un poco finalizar este comentario en esos términos, ¿no? Creo que una de las grandes moralejas de la conversación con Cristiana y de Tomás es justamente que como diseñadores tenemos un montón de cosas que aprender de sistemas vivos y no nada más como diseñadores de productos o diseñadores de artefactos, pero también un poco pensando en estos sistemas sociales que están en constante diseño y en constante construcción. Pues les agradecemos muchísimo nos hayan escuchado y esperamos les haya gustado el episodio con Cristiana y con Tomás.
You're listening to Design in Transition Podcast, brought to you by
Marisol Ortega,
Nandini Nair,
Erica Dorn,
Alex Polzin,
Sofía Bosch Gómez,
Silvana Juri, with the support of the School of Design at Carnegie Mellon University. The audio production was done by Kyle Levy. Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and follow us on Twitter and Instagram as we release new episodes. You can find us at The In Transition. We welcome direct messages about new guest suggestions, ideas, and comments. Until the next episode,